coming in later today or perhaps maybe early tomorrow morning.
All right, very good. All right, so Peter, let me just say hello. I haven't seen you here before.
No, first time. I probably learned about it on my Jewish Learning newsletter. Does that sound right?
That's possible. I didn't know that it's featured there, but...
Well, maybe not.
No problem.
I'm in rural coastal Maine, over an hour from the nearest synagogue, Jewish on my mother's side, but never observant, and I'm taking this time to explore.
Excellent. Well, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thanks. So
just to explain what we're doing here, let's see. Okay, there's Stephen. Stephen's back. So just to explain what we're doing here, I am committed, I am dedicated to furthering the word, the teachings of my teacher, Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who was a very interesting and colorful figure. I don't know if you know anything about him or his background, but just the quick summary is that he founded a movement called Jewish Renewal, and Jewish Renewal was kind of like the Judaism for the hippies, I would say. It has to do with combining Judaism and the New Age, you know, the Age of Aquarius. Reb Zalman himself was Orthodox. He grew up... Stephen, I think we're getting feedback from your microphone. Can you just go on mute for a sec? Let me just see if that's...
I think it's me.
Yeah, I think it is. There was a big hiss. So please feel free to unmute yourself if you want to say something, but leave it like that because it's better for me to not have the hiss. But basically, he grew up Orthodox, and he was born in Poland. And he came to the United States in 1941. He became a Lubavitch rabbi, a Chabad rabbi. But he was influenced by American Judaism probably more than most Orthodox rabbis. And what was happening in the late 50s and early 60s, he decided that he wanted to do LSD. And he took LSD with Timothy Leary in 1963. So that was a significant moment, I would say, in terms of his change. And then in 1968, he founded Jewish Renewal, and the Lubavitchers kind of distanced themselves from him. Though in my eyes, he continued to be Orthodox till the end of his life, but he was doing it in a way that people wouldn't recognize as necessarily Orthodox. So what we're doing is we're looking at the text of a book that he wrote in Hebrew that has never been translated into English. And we're just sort of working our way through it, and I hope one day that I will be publishing what we're doing here. When I spoke to him before, I worked for him for 25 years as a gabbai assistant. I helped him in some of his publications. And I spoke to him about this book, which he never envisioned as translating it into English, because for him it was the version of his teachings that was for the Orthodox community. And he felt that to go to all the trouble to translate the rabbinics and just to put everything in English where the people who are studying it might not have a background of the scriptural basis of what he was teaching, he just thought it wasn't worth the effort. So we talked about it a few times about whether or not I should do this project. And eventually he said, you know what? He said, as long as you put your voice into it, go ahead and do it. He still didn't feel that it was worth it to go to the effort to translate his words. But he was very happy for me to do a project in which I shared what was my inspiration from his teachings. So that's why these classes are so important, because it's giving me a chance to kind of get out what I see in these texts. And so I'm not sure what the final format of the book is going to be. Originally, I was thinking that it wasn't going to be his work in translation with my commentary, which would be the normal way to do it. It would be his words in Hebrew, his words in English, and then maybe some footnotes of mine. So originally I was thinking he didn't want me to do that, but Rabbi Hoffman was like, of course that's the way it has to be. So in any event, we're working on a book, we're working our way through a book, and I've actually been meeting with the rabbi of this synagogue. We're on a site for a conservative synagogue in Yardley, Pennsylvania. Though actually, I'm the only person who's a member of that synagogue in this call right now. Dr. Weiss is in Chicago, and Zisha is in Wisconsin, right? Right, Zisha? And Stephen is in Philadelphia, but he lives in a different area of Philadelphia. So normally we have some more people from Bethel, but in any event, we'll start. I wanted to begin with. We had a text last time in which one of the Hasidic rabbis was teaching that in the future all of these tzaddikim would be sitting in a circle and would be pointing to God. And the point of that text was that each one of us understands God in a different way. That God is not one thing to everybody. And so when each person points to God, that's as valid as anybody else pointing to God, that there's no right way of understanding God and there's no right way of worshiping God. But this idea of tzaddikim is an idea that that puts us onto a path where one person is saying that I'm better than you, or I'm you're better than me. The idea of tzaddik is something which, if somebody said, I'm a tzaddik, then that would be a sin in a way, because a tzaddik is such a high thing to aspire to. So Zisha asked the question, how could we possibly think of ourselves when this text is talking about tzaddikim? And so we were talking about that, and I alluded to a discussion that came up from a video that was shared with me recently from 1978, in which Art Green and Reb Zalman are being interviewed in Berkeley, California. So I wanted to start off by showing an excerpt from that because I think it was relevant to what we were discussing last time. So just give me a second while I get it set up here. The quality of the video is not so great, but you'll be able to hear the discussion, and then we'll talk about it in a second.
Somehow has to involve submission and acceptance. And here you are very busy being autonomous, going to the ultimate in this place, the general, or the flight of the one to the one, but doing it in an autonomous way as your spirit going into the ultimate. But how do you do that without humility?
So let me just, I just want to stop and just to give the context. They're talking about autonomy and heteronomy. The idea is that religion for all time was a religion of heteronomy, which means that that God told us what the commandments were. God said, do this, do that. And so we were following God's will. And if we weren't following God's will, we were following our tradition. We were following the way that people have codified the tradition. Now we come into the 20th century and we're more knowledgeable about Freud and Jung and the way that things work and the way that we process things. But where does humility come in? And I just want to get this to focus a little bit better here. There we go. So where does humility come in? So Art Green is saying that for the Jewish renewal people, that you have to also be humble, and humility is an important thing. And so he gets this question all the time: how can you have such chutzpah to think that you can change Judaism, define God in a new way? You know, where do you get the chutzpah for that? So now we'll hear Reb Zalman's answer.
And how do you pick and choose in the tradition humbly? I hear myself ask that question all the time, so let me throw it at you today. Or is humility something that's overcome here?
The same way as there's no love, but there's just which level on love and the love hate continuum you are, right? So there is no such a thing as humility without being on the pride humility level. I mean, go to the what do you call letters, the worm? Screw tape letters, right? All right, wood is there, right? And he has this great thing: if you can't get your client to be proud, then get him to be proud that he's humble. If you can't get him to be proud that he's humble, get him to be proud that he's humble. Now, it's forget it. This one, I've already decided is a great monkey wrenching consciousness. Doesn't lead anywhere, and you have to, it won't be either pride or humility. It's the question of what mix of pride and humility are we dealing with. Okay. So I want to know, what is a good mix, an optimal mix of pride and humility?
Well, isn't it so that just this sort of question is the sort of thing that
all right, that's
possible way
sorry,
I'd
let
like
me just
start the conversation just with kind of a question which I suppose everybody would put it in
there. Yeah, I play the video on another device just because when the sound goes through the internet, sometimes with the video, I think it works better that way. Anyway, so the question is that... the answer is that there is no such thing as absolute pride or absolute humility. It's a line, and it's a grid. You know, you go from being humble to being proud. It's kind of like the idea that you have two pieces of paper in your pocket. It says, "For me, the entire world was created," and for the other, it says, "I am dust and ashes." So we are all on this continuum, and the idea is, where's the optimal place? If you're too humble, then you're not going to assert for yourself. You're not going to share your position with people. If you're too proud, then you're too caught up in yourself, and you're not focused on God. So somehow we need to find a balance, and this is true for everybody, whether they're Jewish renewal or Orthodox, whoever they are. They have to find the proper balance for these things. I just thought it was, and he was alluding to a book, the letters. I can't remember, the Screw Tape Letters or something. I haven't read it.
It's called the Screw Tape Letters. It's by C.S. Lewis, and it's about these letters by one of the lower devils of the lower orders to one of the devils in of the upper orders.
Right, so he was saying that if a person comes along and the Satan is trying to trip him up, and so if the person says, "Well, I'm very humble," then the Satan is going to say to him, "Oh, you're very proud that you're so humble, aren't you?" And if that doesn't get him, he says, "No, but I'm actually humble that I'm humble." Then he'll say, "Oh, well, you're really proud that you're humble that you're humble." You know, so he keeps throwing this thing at him to try to get him to. Anyway, that was the example that he gave. But I just thought that was so interesting because I think Reb Zalman is accused of being, you know, too egotistical or too proud or whatever. How else can you create a whole new kind of Judaism? You know, you have to have a little bit of self-confidence to go onto that path. All right, let me just get my text up here. Just give me a second because I'm a little behind this morning.
Seth, and I might also add that you actually have to have in you the spirit of some self-congratulatory aspect, which isn't very humble, of course, but you should take a moment to realize when you've come upon something worthwhile and not just say, this is also dust and ashes, that really capitalize on things that came to you as a flash of thinking or some hard work that got something accomplished. And really, not to recognize it would cause it to fall away and not be, you know, not move forward.
Yeah, I mean, my own experience was that I had narcissistic tendencies when I was growing up, which people think that means that that you're egotistical. It actually means that you have a very troubled sense of self in reality. And that your ego is so fragile that you need to talk to yourself about yourself in a way that disconnects you from other people, and it also has an impact on the way that you treat other people. But you know, I thought I was pretty special when I was growing up. At the same time, I was very insecure and felt that I didn't have the ability to be happy because I wasn't going to be successful. So it's a mixed bag, and I, like many others, was attracted to Reb Zalman because of his strength and you know, I really do think that in Jewish renewal there's many, many narcissists. I would have to say that there's many people. You know, I don't know if you could characterize a whole group like that, but certainly the people that were in his inner circle, who I dealt with a lot, I had a lot of trouble with those relationships because we didn't listen well to each other because we were each so caught up in our pride in being part of the Reb Zalman community. Now, what I'm saying here is really part of the fruits of about 11 or 12 years continuous therapy that I've been going through. And at the point when my therapist told me that I had narcissistic tendencies, it took me about 3 months before I could see any reality in what she had said. So I'm not trying to pat myself on the back or anything, but just to give a little bit, you know, the reason why this excerpt is so interesting to me is partly because of my own situation here.
Yeah, just as an aside, I would add that when my wife and I were in counseling many years ago, the therapist said that I too had narcissistic tendencies. There seems to be a lot of it going around.
Well, yeah, I mean, our president has quite a bit more than tendencies.
Well, he has a disorder. He's his is malignant. I don't think ours is.
Oh my God! Yeah. Well, yeah. She said I wasn't a narcissist. I just had tendencies. So that was the good news. All right. Bring up the text for today. Here we go. Okay, let me share it now. Okay, so last time we were talking about, let me get rid of this window here. Last time we were talking about the diversity of spirit and the diversity of avoda, which is how we worship God. And we were giving forth this idea of how important diversity is, how important it is that each one of us bring our voice to the situation, bring our voice to what's needed in our time, what's needed in the world today. When I was growing up, I didn't have this notion of diversity. I had this notion, I grew up in Brooklyn, and I grew up in a community that was split between Italians and Jews. And the Italians and the Jews were kind of like, they were like in groups, you know. There would be a group of Jews and a group of Italians, and the interface was not so nice. I remember when I was with my cousin, one time we got attacked by a gang of kids. And so I definitely, and I also was insecure about my Judaism. I felt that I didn't feel Jewish pride. I felt perhaps a little ashamed and perhaps a little neurotic about being Jewish. But my daughters, growing up in suburban Pennsylvania, really, really had this notion of diversity put into them. And over the last 10 or 15 years in my workplace, I've also gone through a transformation in which diversity has become very, very important and very, very serious to me. So that if I'm dealing with someone on my team who has a different perspective than I might have, I'm much more patient and much more interested in learning what it is that they have to say. So I think Reb Zalman found this text from the 1700s, which also brought forth this notion that every one of us is special. Now, in the 1700s, they were saying that Jews were better than non-Jews. We're not saying that anymore. We're saying that the diversity extends beyond Judaism, and it extends beyond how you practice Judaism, and it extends beyond we would say that the geese and the fish need to also be honored for their life. Now, that's not to say that everyone is good in equal measure. We still have this continuum of good and evil and morality and everything like that. But on a certain very basic level, different cultures and different ways of being and different ways of worshiping God, we can't really say that one is better than another. We can't say that the Indonesian way of doing spirit is not as good as the Jewish way, etc., etc. So one of the things that came up in this discussion that we were having was this notion of a minyan. And when they talked about the minyan, they always say that a minyan of 10 is special because the Shekhinah resides with the minyan. And so the Shekhinah is the indwelling of God's presence on this plane. And so Reb Zalman now has actually a new section in the book called What is the matter of Shekhinah? What is this? What are we talking about when we talk about the indwelling of God? And so that's what we're now, that's the subject at hand of this paragraph. So he says, one must contemplate whatever situation in which there are children of Israel on the planet, whether in past or future, there was an imagination about what is God, what is Hashem. And that imagination is what the Shekhinah is. So he's defining right away that if we want to talk about the indwelling of God on this plane, he said, let's just look throughout Jewish history. Let's just look throughout all the places that there are Jews. And when they get together and they talk about what is the presence, that is the way he's going to define what Shekhinah is. And then he says, as scripture states, her master is known in the gates, which we've seen is also the word gates can be translated as imagination. Of course, in the original pshat, the basic level of the text from Proverbs, they're talking about Eshet Chayil, the woman of valor, and they're saying that she's married to somebody who has a reputation in the local community. But the rabbis have taken it to mean that the wife, the wife of virtue, is actually all of Israel, and that her husband is God. And so that her, and they trans, they also translate that her master is known in the gates means that she has an awareness, or that Israel has an awareness of God. And Reb Zalman says, this is the Holy One of Blessing. That God is to be made known, or to make oneself, or to make one's self known. And I translated self with a capital S, because they talk about little self as being, you know, me and Zisha and Dr. Weiss, but the big self, which is also part of each of us, is God. So that the Holy One of Blessing is, has made the self inside of each of us known. And then to be attached to or joined with, in accord with that which the person imagines in their heart, each person as per their ability to cleave to a spirit of God's wisdom, and according to that which the person can imagine in his or her heart. So let me just stop there and just say that when I first came to Reb Zalman, I was an agnostic. I didn't believe in God. I didn't know what God was. I didn't have an understanding of that word. But I was still very excited to go to shul. I was still very excited to daven. I was still very excited to learn and study with Reb Zalman and to learn some of these texts. And it was only later on, because originally I had thought, I had this conception that in order to believe in God, one had to kind of discount science in a way. How could you believe in miracles? How can you believe in things which we know are not true? Everything that I read in the Torah I knew wasn't true, I believed wasn't true. And so it wasn't possible for me to connect my notion of reality and my notion of God. They were kind of in two different places. But Reb Zalman taught me that there was something inside of me which was a strong desire to be a good person, or a strong desire to do things the right way, or a strong desire to, a great love for symbol, a great love for myth, a great love for metaphor, and all of these kinds of things, and that feeling was a feeling that I could put in the direction of, let's just call that God. I mean, he taught me that I could use the word God and I could connect it to who I already was. So obviously I had emotions and I had thoughts, but I just couldn't put them into the direction of God. So it was through studying with Reb Zalman that I was able to make that change. But the beautiful thing was he empowered me to say that the Jewish tradition and my own tradition were aligned with each other. That was the great shift, because in Orthodoxy I had come across with the idea, it had come across to me the idea that somebody, some committee somewhere was making decisions on behalf of Judaism. And if I didn't go to yeshiva and I didn't study a certain way, and if I didn't live a certain way, then I was not welcome to the table. I was not welcome to be a member of that committee. And that was the huge shift for me when Reb Zalman said, you are empowered to be a member, to sit at that table. You are the consensus of the committed. You are committed, and it doesn't matter to me whether you ate, you know, non-kosher food for many years. He never asked me about what my particular halacha was. He never asked me. He just loved me. It says on his tombstone that he loved people to God. He loved me to God. That's exactly what he did. He loved me to God. By being loved by him, I was able to get over my post-traumatic stress disorder from Hebrew school. and to get to a place where I could love God. So I just wanted to add that, so we'll continue with the text. So I just want to empower each one of you, wherever you are in your theology, wherever you are in your belief in God or your disbelief in God, wherever you are in terms of how good or evil you think you are as a person and the things you need to work on in yourself or whatever, you're all tzaddikim, and you all have a way of loving God that is necessary for the world. It's necessary for what we call Israel. In the context of these studies, we call it Israel, but it's more general than Israel.
Seth, can I just make one little
please,
comment?
Please, please, please.
So you'll refer to the fact that it is a common phenomenon among people who studied in any aspect of school, university, that then when they indulge in science, they become more wary of some of the things told to us in the Torah as in sheer disbelief because it's in such conflict. And yet, on another plane, you could say, if you indulge heavily, say, in the sciences, the physical sciences, one can't help but notice the similarity in the stamp upon which all the things we encounter in the universe, whether it be physical matter that we can appreciate or physical matter that we can make determinations about or estimates about, that there are unifying concepts and rules. I've mentioned before when we had these discussions that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who himself was a student both of Torah and of science in a formal way, in his formal training in Berlin and in the Sorbonne, that he, like someone like yourself, Seth, or myself, or someone here in the discussion, saw a work like Isaac Newton as unifying the idea that there are so many things about the universe that have a unity of a stamp of creation, that it, in a sense, affirms the creation by a single power. There was one way by which this was all done, one way by which rules of nature unify the motions of planets and other aspects of celestial bodies, that there really is almost the affirmation as you study the science that there is actually unity of creation. There is one creator. And yet it's surprising that even in my own family, where we have some very great scientists in the family, they go the opposite direction and say, this affirms fully that there wasn't a creator. We've got a thinking process about this that is in complete controversy and complete opposite. It's quite a dichotomy of thinking. I think I would go with what more the Rebbe did was when he looked at Isaac Newton's unification of the idea of how heavenly bodies move by a kind of a universal law, which has been refined by Einstein and others, but it still is the concept that there is a stamp of unity of creation as you indulge in sciences and powers of observation.
Yes, I mean, it's very personal. It's really personal, and it's okay that it's so personal. We don't all have to line up and see things the same way. I was always, when I read The Jew and the Lotus, I don't know if you people have read that book, that was a huge book for me because I was, like the author, Roger Kamenetz, who was an agnostic, going on this journey of spirituality. Those kinds of books really, really grabbed me. They were great. They were great for me because of where I was in terms of my own theology. Other people, it comes very natural. They believe in God. They've always believed in God. I'm going to just go and get a sweater. I'm a little cold. I'll be right back. Excuse me.
Peter, is your field in any area related to religion, or is more in the secular sphere?
I worked. I'm retired. I worked for the government in international relations, and kind of following my mother toward the end of her life, got more interested in participating in Judaism, and I can sort of see myself following the same path. So it's on the one hand, this isolation is very good at this point in time. Well, it's also good because a lot more things are online these days. You might not have had this online discussion without the pandemic. But I just want to say, I realized how I found out about this. The Temple's Inner Torah group was on my Jewish Learning daily email blast, and I went to the Temple's website and found this.
Okay. All right, so going back to the text now. All right, so so each one, as per their ability to cleave to a spirit of God's wisdom and according to that which the person can imagine in their heart. You know, we struggle with the pronouns. Reb Zalman had created a couple of pronouns, like for his and her, he had H-I-R, which sometimes I use. And now people are saying they because gender is much more fluid. So I'm not quite sure exactly what to do, but anyway. Such being made known in the heart, and in this way is God known in the gates. And we looked at this text, we'll just quickly look at it again, the Zohar HaKodesh 1:103, which talks about this connection between God, between the text from Proverbs and God being in our imagination. So here's the text from the Zohar. It says, "The way of women had ceased for Sarah. At that moment she discovered herself in delight menstruating once again. So she said, 'My husband is old. He isn't fit to engender a child. He's an old man.' Rabbi Yehuda opened and he said, 'Her husband is known in the gates. As he sits among the elders of the land,'" that's the original text from Proverbs, "'come and see, the Blessed Holy One has ascended in glory. He is hidden, concealed in utmost loftiness. There is no one in the world, nor since the day was created has there ever been, who can comprehend his wisdom or apprehend him, for he is hidden, concealed, transcendent, beyond, beyond. All beings above and below cannot grasp until they finally declare, blessed be the glory of Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, from his place. Those below proclaim that he is above, as is written, your glory is above in the heavens. Those above proclaim," meaning the angels, "that he is below, as is written, your glory is over all the earth. Finally, all of them above and below declare, blessed be the glory of God from his place, for God is unknowable. No one has ever been able to comprehend God, yet you say her husband is known in the gates? But indeed, her husband is known in the gates, the Blessed Holy One, who is known and grasped to the degree that each one opens the gates of imagination, according to the capacity to attain the spirit of wisdom. As one fathoms in their mind, so God is known in their mind. So God is known in those gates. But can God be known accurately? No one has ever been able to grasp and know God. Rabbi Shimon said, her husband is known in the gates. Who are the gates? As it is said, lift up your heads, O gates. Be lifted up, openings of eternity. Through these gates, supernal rungs, the Holy One becomes known. Otherwise, no one could grasp." So this text, it really underlines the notion that each one of us needs to go into our imagination. God is not going to be anywhere besides in our imagination. If you think you're going to find God by going in a rocket ship into outer space, that's not the case. You're not going to find God in the black hole or in the Big Bang, I guess. You're not going to find God where you can see God, where you can touch God, where you can smell God, but you're going to see and you're going to touch and you're going to smell, and God is in those things. So it's kind of a little bit of a paradox. But God is known in the gates of imagination. It is written, "The will of those in awe will God do." God will do the will of those in awe. "And God will hear their cry and save them." So here I tried a different pronoun here, you can see. "For there is a difference between an end and a will." So here he wants to say that what we need to do is to take God's will into our way of deciding how to prioritize what we're going to do. So in other words, it's a subtle distinction, because if I decide that I'm going to do something, if I decide that I must do something, that it's part of my ought. I ought to do something. And then I do that thing. So he's going to try to talk about the distinction between when I'm doing that as an extension of God's will versus when I'm doing that because I decide to do that, but I don't bring God into the situation. And he tries to explain this. In other words, one who has an end does not distinguish between the means as to whether they are in accord with the ethics or not, for all that person's ambition is just to reach the end, which is not the case if there is someone who has a will motivating him from inside his soul. Only then, besides attaining the end, he has the way of approaching God's end, and then it is impossible for the person to do something in order to reach God's end where the means are incompatible with the end. Then the mitzvah, the holy commandment, is in the person and not just his having an objective. So let me just stop there for just a quick discussion. Can you understand the difference? I mean, I struggled with this, to try to understand the difference between deciding to do something versus having God's will telling you to do something. He's making that as a distinction. He's saying that on the one hand, you're not going to be so worried about the way you do it. On the other hand, you're going to be much more concerned about how you do it. So, I mean, I guess that's a pretty good summary of what he's saying. So he says, this is what King David, Olav HaShalom, read peace upon him, said. He said, righteous is Hashem, is God, in all God's ways, that all God's ways are just and kind in all God's deeds. And then Red Zalman says, i.e., within the line of the law, so that as long as you're following the law, then God's ways are just and God is kind in all God's deeds. So once again, this needs some explanation. Why is it so? Because Hashem is near to him, to all who call him. Now, all these lines are from the Ashrei prayer, I should say. Ashrei Yoshevei Beitecha, Psalm 145, Od Yaluchas, Psalm 45, right? He cites it here. Maybe not. 17. And then in Deuteronomy says, and kind in all God's deeds within the line of the law. Why is it so? Because Hashem is near to all who call him. They evoke him in God's self. For God Yitbarach is the one concerned with the matter for the Holy One of blessing, is seized with a desire to have a dwelling in the lower places. And they call on God Yitbarach in a real way. So this is what I was trying to say before, is that Reb Zalman helped me to turn my moral ethical compass, if you will, to turn my my love of poetry and imagination, to turn that into the direction of God. And now we're going to look at a couple more texts that make this point, that bring this point home. Bereshit Rabbah 3:9 and Tanchuma Naso. Okay, first the Bereshit Rabbah. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Ami said, from the beginning of creation of the world, did the Holy One of Blessing desire to make a partnership with those below. From the very beginning of creation, it was God's desire to make a partnership with those below. So there's two points of view. One point of view says that we can't know anything about God's desire. That's the non-Hasidic point of view, that there's the curtain between us and heaven is so thick that we're deluding ourselves. If we might want to think that we're in relationship with God, but we're just deluding ourselves. But the Hasidic point of view says, no, no, no. God had a desire, and God wanted to be in partnership with us, and that we have some of God's DNA, you could say. And so this Bereishit Rabbah text supports that. How can you say this? How can you say that the Holy One of Blessing had a desire to be in partnership with us? So they go to the text in Bereishit. It says Bereishit bara Elokim, and it says Vayihi or Vayihi Choshech Yom Echad. So in the very first, in the beginning of Bereishit, it says there was light, there was darkness, and it says one day. But then on the second day, when he creates the firmament, he says the second day, and the third day, and the fourth day, the fifth day, the sixth day. So this text is drawing upon this linguistic subtlety that when it says the first day, it doesn't say the first day, it says one day, or day one. So he says, if it was just a question of accounting, or God had to just say which day it was, then he could only say it was 1, 2, 3, or he could say it was the first or second or third day. But why does it say one, and then it says second and third? That's surprising. So then it says, when did the Holy One of Blessing solve this dilemma, this question about why it says one, and then it says second? So, and then they go to another text related to the setting up of the tabernacle, as it says, the one who presented his offering on the first day. And so they say that at that time, which was the day when the tabernacle went into operation, it was when the princes were delivering their offerings to the temple, and that it said that at that point the text was corrected. Now it said the first day because it was waiting for the partnership to happen between us and between God and humanity, that that when the tabernacle was created, at that point this issue got resolved, and that is that that was the day when creation was completed. So the Holy One of Blessing, the Holy One of Blessing said, just a second. Okay, said the Holy One of Blessing, it is as if on that day I created my world. It is taught 10 crowns that day I received. It was the first, so there were 10 crowns received. We won't go into all the different crowns that were received on that day. But the point is that it was the partnership that God was waiting for. And the second text makes the same point. This is Midrash Tanhuma on the same section that we were just reading in Bereishit Rabbah. So it was the same day, the day that the tabernacle was set up. It happened on that day that Moses finished setting up the tabernacle. Rav says, every place where it is stated and it happened, Vayihi, it's something new. But Reb Shimeon says, every place where it says and it happened, it's something that had ceased for a long time and has returned to be as it was. In other words, when the tabernacle was created, it was something that we had previously, and this is how we know it, because in the Song of Songs it states, I have come to my garden, my sister, my bride, and the Song of Songs preceded the creation of the tabernacle. Reb Samuel Bar Nachman says, at the time when the Holy One, blessed be He, created the world, God longed to have an abode below, just as God had on high. Having created Adam, he commanded Adam, and he said, you may freely eat of any tree in the garden, but as for the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you may not eat of it. Then Adam transgressed against the commandment. The Holy One, blessed be, he said this to him, this is what I long for, that just as I have a dwelling on high, I would likewise to have one below. But now, when I have given you one command, you have not kept it. Immediately, the Holy One, blessed be He, removed the divine presence up to the first firmament. Where is it shown? Where it is stated that then they heard the voice of the Lord God moving in the garden. So they said that that movement meant that God moved away. Now, when they transgressed the commandment, God only removed the divine presence of the first firmament, but was still close to us. But then Cain arose and killed Abel, and so God immediately removed the divine presence of the second firmament. The Holy One, blessed be He, said, I created seven firmaments, and up to now there are wicked ones arising. So what did God do? He folded away all the generations of the wicked, and He raised up Abraham. When Abraham arose and performed good works, the Holy One, blessed be, immediately descended from the seventh firmament to the sixth. When Isaac arose and stretched out his neck on the altar, he descended from the sixth to the fifth. When Moses arose and he brought it down to the earth, as it is stated, and the Lord came down onto Mount Sinai. And so it is written in Song of Songs, I have come to my garden, my sister, my bride, when the tabernacle was set up. So you see this beautiful, beautiful text from the tradition that supports this notion that God was interested in a partnership with us, and that it is incumbent on each of us to do our part to consummate the relationship, if you will, to bring God close to each one of us. So, and I'll just finish the paragraph here of Zalman, and then we'll end the session. So he says that they call on God in a real, that they call on God in a real way, not your world to come, not your Garden of Eden, only you alone. So he has this in Yiddish here. He says, "Nit dein olam haba, nit dein gan Eden, nur dich allein," which was a quote from Schnorr Zalman of Liadi, the founder of the Chabad Hasidus, and then he translates it into Hebrew. He says, "Lo ha olam haba shelocha, the lo ha gan Eden shelocha, ella otcha levad." I'm interested in you alone. And so it is this relationship, it is this nearness that we're trying to bring, that Reb Zalman is trying to put into us. And they too, in inwardness of their will, are concerned with the matter in a real way. That the people who are bringing God's will into their will are concerned with the matter, with the thing, with the matter. And then apart from the end, that the people who live this way, who do the mitzvot, they want the details to be for the sake of heaven. And in loving kindness and mercy, that by means of these mitzvot, will the divine oversight be recognizable for all the world. So through our actions, that's how God's presence comes into the world. May every creature know that you are its maker, as it says in Isaiah. And that all that is should be through God saying it should be so, because my glory was God's creating, God's formation, and even God's making. And you see these words from Berea, Yetzira, and Asiya, they come into this text from Isaiah. So maybe this is where the worlds of Berea, Yetzira, and Asiya come from, perhaps maybe from this text. So anyway, that's our little snippet for today. Glad you could join us. We're not going to meet next week because of the secular holiday. So we'll meet again in a couple of weeks. And Peter, please, happy to have you. Please feel free to join anytime. We meet every Thursday at 9 o'clock. Take care, everybody. Have a great day. Don't let the situation in Washington get you down, or try not to. And hopefully everything will sort its way out to everyone's satisfaction. Of course, not to everyone's satisfaction, but at least to those people who believe in democracy and want to preserve democracy.
Can I just go back to something you were referring to? You referred to the creation of, say, the men, or the men who didn't behave right, Cain and Abel, or the people in the garden who didn't behave right. So if you were, say, a researcher in a laboratory and developed some idea with a chemical or with a device, and the idea backfired on you and it was destructive more than you anticipated, or it was actually dangerous or blew up in your face or in your lab, you'd do your best to eradicate it so this doesn't continue and you reshape your experiments or your developments in your project. Was this the situation that God encountered? Was even though he is all-knowing and all-seeing and can anticipate the future, he is supposed to have a power that we don't have. We should figure that we would make these experiments with the idea that we have a good idea, but we can't predict that it might not blow up in our face or blow up in the whole world's face. But wouldn't God have had the capability with his master of the universe to have anticipated the errant behavior of, say, Cain and Abel? Cain. Or the apparent behavior of the world that he had to destroy at the time of Noah in the time of the flood. How does that work? I just want to refer to something that is referred to in this paragraph you just read to us. You at your experimental bench would be privileged to make those mistakes, but is God, with his ability to really have complete mastery of the universe, is it anticipated that he could make such an error if it's called an error? How does this work?
Great. We learn from our mistakes, and we've been given free will. And so when that happened, God knew what God was doing, so to speak.
But say you are God, and you couldn't make mistakes because you have such an anticipation of the next step. You can actually predict the next movement of all the molecules or anything that was involved with the so-called mistake. How does this happen? That if you're the creator who has this foresight, as opposed to the creator like a man who doesn't have this foresight.
Maybe those, what we're saying are mistakes, are teaching moments that we learn from those mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, you figure that the scientist that it blows up from didn't intend for that to happen.
No, he couldn't predict the future that well. He couldn't predict the behavior of his project well enough to see that this didn't work. I mean, that's just the nature of how we approach anything we develop. You know, we go ahead and we raise children a certain way and we're wrong. And we say, Hashem knew, but God knew for our mistake, but we'll try to improve on the next child who comes along or whatever the situation exists. But in God's case, where he's the master of the universe and is said to be the forecaster of everything, then the anticipation mistake is built into the creation, and I just don't.
Yeah, no, your comment is pushing us to put our imagination in God's direction, which is what the text is asking us to do. So you're doing what Zalman is asking us to do, and we should all do what Zalman is asking us to do to try to put our minds toward God's minds, so that we can bring these two things together.
I have to cogitate on this more.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, thanks everybody. Have a great day.
Thanksgiving. Shabbos.
Shabbat Shalom.
Welcome, Peter. Nice to have you join us. Okay. Bye-bye.